permanently with the FBI, also helped work on the case, but it's not clear. Another reference states that in at least one investigation, the Bureau's CIU passed on intelligence information to investigating members, some of whom were assigned to the JTTF. We have no idea what that means. The 2013 paragraph in which the chief states he asks the city attorney to independently verify there are no violations of Oregon law or federal law is now missing. However, later in the report, the chief states the city attorney verified such a statement. It's not clear how that's possible since A, the city attorney does not have secret clearance, and B, for example, the Portland police cooperated in the FBI sting of Mohammed Mohammed, in which warrantless wiretapping was used to build the case. Such wiretapping is considered by many people to be unconstitutional. As with the 2012 report, the chief says no officers did JTTF work outside of Portland. We don't know much more about when they did. Unlike previous years, the chief does not write that he conferred with the commissioner in charge to determine how many officers to assign to the JTTF. Whether this is related to Mayor Hale's lack of security clearance is unclear, since Mayor Adams also never obtained his security clearance but was consulted. This leads to a major concern about the entire enterprise of the Bureau's cooperation with the JTTF. The resolution allowing that cooperation is based on the idea the commissioner will have the same security clearance as the chief and be able to oversee use of city employees for federal investigations. Mayor Adams never received clearance, and Mayor Hales has gone a year without clearance, meaning the PPB's participation has gone without meaningful oversight from elected officials in the entire 3 years since the resolution passed. The chief still describes a special agent in charge of the FBI meeting on several occasions rather than giving the exact number. He did say that you can go through his log to find out when he had those meetings, but nobody's going to take the time to do that. If it's public information, it should be in the report. There's no mention that the SEC was reassigned and that the resolution requires a meeting within 30 days with any new SEC to affirm Portland's quasi-participatory status with the JTTF. And, of course, the SEC's name, while public, is not noted. We have still not received information we requested in 2012 about how many hours officers are working, how much the relationship is costing the city, and how the city and the FBI define the term criminal nexus, which is used to trigger PPB participation in JTTF cases. The standard operating procedure, which should be a public document, was taken down from the PPB's website last year and not linked to in the annual report. And finally, the resolution requires an annual check-in between the city attorney and the Oregon Attorney General about compliance with Oregon law, and we don't know whether this has happened since 2012.
That was Dan Hendelman of Portland Cop Watch speaking at today's city council meeting in downtown Portland. The city council delayed the vote on whether to accept the annual report on the city's participation in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. That item will be brought to next Wednesday's city council meeting. Demonstrators gathered at Portland City Hall this morning to kick off Living Wage Wednesdays, a demand that city council adopt a $15 an hour living wage standard in the city of Portland. The event echoes the recent measure in Seattle, which called for a $15 an hour minimum wage for airport workers, and also mirrors the Moral Monday protests from other parts of the country that have seen more than 1,000 arrested over the last year. Seattle voters also recently elected a socialist city council member whose platform includes a $15 an hour minimum wage for all workers in Seattle. Last week, 87% of voters in Chicago approved an advisory referendum to raise the minimum wage there to $15 an hour. Local housing justice advocate and seasoned organizer Jamu Umis shared his own methods for engaging in the wage debate. Two of the candidates running for Portland City Council, Sharon Maxwell and Nicholas Caleb, also attended the rally and were provided an opportunity to address those gathered. Today's protests mark the beginnings of Living Wage Wednesdays, in which protesters hope to surround the Wednesday morning council meeting to shout and sing and chant the message that people of Portland demand a living wage. Here's KBOO's Jamie Partridge, who was on scene this morning.
We're out here in front of City Hall. A big banner that says $15 now in poverty wages. A few signs say I support a livable wage. A couple dozen folks. This is Ajamu Umi.
People say, well, I don't like socialism because that's redistribution of wealth. And people don't like that because people feel like somebody's getting an opportunity that they didn't get. So people don't like that. Well, first, socialism is not redistribution of wealth. That's not what it is, okay? People in socialist countries, I've been to those countries, they work harder than anybody here ever will work because they're morally incented, not materially incented. So, but you're saying, well, what does that have to do with $15? That's everything. What we have to do is we have to learn how to talk about this with our family, friends, coworkers, neighbors, everybody else. How do we talk about why people should make more money? The way we talk about it is we have to dispel a couple of myths. Number one myth is this concept that the only thing you can hope to achieve in this life is going to a wage slave job every day, giving your lifeblood and energy to somebody else that disrespects you and treats you horribly, and what you can expect to get out of the deal is a house, a car, and maybe a vacation once a year. Because that's what we've been trained to believe. We go through that every day. We live through that. It's traumatizing. It's dehumanizing. And as a result of that, we can barely make it through the day. And if you don't believe that, look at all the people who have drinking problems, drug problems, eating disorders, sex disorders, gambling disorders, everything else, just so we can make it through the day. Obviously, that's a problem. We're miserable in our lives today. So we've got to dispel that myth, number one. That is not the reason why we're here, just to be wage slaves and work for that thing. The other thing that we have to dispel is this concept that, well, we're just out here working, we're just going to work, and there really isn't any connection to what people make, in that if you get advanced college degrees, you should make more money. Isn't that what we're trained? If you have a master's degree, PhD, you have more value because you've got bourgeois education. Well, speaking as a slave with a master's degree, I can say that that's not true, and we have to dispel that myth. Just think about it for a second. How many times in your life do you go to the doctor? Doctor makes big money. How many times do you go to the doctor? If you don't have any serious health issues, maybe once a year at the most, right? How many times do you go to the markets where low-wage people work and get the food that they've stocked for you? How many times do you go out to eat and eat the food that's prepared for you, served to you, cleaned up for you by low-wage workers? How many times do you do that? If we just use a simple supply and demand analysis, obviously these market workers and these restaurant workers have much more value in our life than doctors. How many of you use a lawyer regularly? So how is that more valuable to your life than the person that stocks your groceries? Doesn't that make more sense? That's how you have to talk about it to your family and friends. The other thing we have to say to them is, one of the things, I work with state workers all day, every day. And they always tell me, well, I don't understand why the union's working with these low-wage workers. What has that got to do with me? And so I tell them every time, and when I leave here, I'm going to go tell some more of them, that look, what do you think right to work is? It's an effort to drive your wages down to what the people on the bottom are making. So the best way to protect yourself, dummy, is raise their wages. That's the best way to do that. That is what socialism really is, y'all. I'm just telling you. That's much more of a vision into what it is than redistribution of wealth. That's what we need to build. So when you talk to your family and friends, have those conversations with them. Encourage those conversations. When you have these big corporations like Walmart, and they're paying people nothing, or McDonald's, or Burger King, or any of these crooks and criminals, and they're paying people nothing, then those people make so little money they qualify for food stamps. So what that means is that you and I are subsidizing Walmart, McDonald's, and all those other crooks and pimps, and they make more than enough money. I'm going and talking to workers every day, and they're saying, well, if you pay them more money, they're going to pass it down to me when I buy my hamburger. And I'm like, well, did you see McDonald's balance sheet? You don't know what their profit margin is. Why are you being such a prostitute defending McDonald's? They make enough money that can pay people way more money than even these people are asking for that they justly deserve. So those are the conversations that we need to have with people. The other thing people say that we have to dispel is that, well, that'll just raise our cost for everything. No, if we organize and we make sure that we don't go in any of these places until they raise people's salaries, they're going to raise them eventually. They're going to raise them. That's what's going to happen. And then after they do that, if we continue to organize and we say, if you pass the cost down to us, we're still not going to shop there, they won't do it. The power is with you. It's not in these buildings, y'all. It's with you. Take your power and let's build the society we want.
We know that a living wage is for everyone, no matter what your skin color, no matter what your background. And it's time that we bring a shared value community to City Hall. We need leaders that will have the political courage and will to make sure that all people have a quality of life here in Portland.
Sharon Maxwell, running for City Council.
There's a lot of stuff going on in Portland right now, a lot of energy that's rising. The Portland State professors are getting ready to strike. The city workers are getting ready to strike. The Portland teachers almost struck. There's a lot of energy and angst in the city about the way that average workers are being treated. And so this is just one more version of that angst coming to the surface. And I think you'll see in the next 2 months that Portland's going to be a really exciting place to be.
All right, Nick Caleb, running for city council and helping to kick off the 15 Now campaign out in front of City Hall here today on Wednesday. Jamie Partridge, Cable News.
This morning, houseless advocate Michael Withey made a presentation at the Portland City Council meeting. Withey's appearance was a preview of the plan he'll be presenting at a Human Rights Commission meeting on April 2nd. The plan details how to provide low-cost, affordable housing and services to Portland's houseless population. Withey's current working with the Lentz Neighborhood Association to build Portland's first low-income eco-community. He's the originator of the six-point plan to end homelessness in Portland, which provides an alternative to the city's so-called 10-year plan to end homelessness. KBOO's Ken Jones has more.
We're here today with Michael Withey, homeless advocate. Michael will be presenting at the Human Rights Commission meeting on Wednesday, April 2nd, 4 to 6:30 at 421 Southwest 6th Avenue, Suite 500. This is an open meeting and the public is invited. Michael, what's the purpose of the presentation?
We're going to be presenting innovative ideas on low-income housing and stuff that really hasn't been accomplished here in Portland. When I say low-income housing, I mean housing people can afford.
How would you define low-income affordable housing? What is affordable?
Well, affordable, if you're working a minimum wage job and possibly raising kids, I think most people can only afford a few hundred bucks. Affordable housing to me is $300, $250, $350.
So really, this is a large portion of the homeless that have income coming in, but not enough to pay for rent in the current conditions in Portland.
Actually, the federal government states that 40% of the people that are on the street right now have an income, whether it be SSI or SSD or even retirement accounts. So unfortunately, those 40% of the people that are on the street cannot afford to live in typical housing situations and pay their utilities. So they're forced either into renting someone's room or living on the street.
Will you be presenting solutions at the Human Rights Commission?
I am. I'm going to be presenting some pretty unique plans that we have in the works and some plans that are already underway.
Can you tell us what some of those plans are?
I partnered up with a group called Home First Development, Dave Carboneau and Rob Justice. And what they've done is they've secured $10 million to build 500 low-income units in Portland over the next 5 years. The rents start at $350. And so that's definitely low-income housing. So I've teamed up with them to develop eco-communities together with TechDwell out of Hillsboro. And these are assemblable units. They're beautiful little homes. They last a very long time. You can take them down and put them up. And they rent for $250. Also, affordable housing.
And Michael, you were telling me earlier that some of these already exist.
Well, Home First Development have already built many units in Roseburg. This year, they're building, I believe, 125 in Portland. These units are everywhere from little micro apartments that rent for $350 up to three-bedroom apartments for families, and I think they're probably more, $600, $700. I can't say for sure. I'm not actually part of Home First Development. Mm-hmm. I'm working with Home First Development on developing these eco-communities.
The solution that's currently in effect in Roseburg, that's what you'd like to see adapted in Portland?
Well, they've already taken the money to build 500 units in Portland, and they're breaking ground, and they're building 100 and some this year in Portland. So that's already a done deal. They're building 500 in the next 5 years, already paid for it. They're already paid for it, and they're already contracted to do it. What I'm hoping to do at this meeting is to get them more financial backing so that they can build more.
After your presentation at the Human Rights Commission meeting, what would be the next steps?
So the next step would be to get a group of people together that are professional, that are willing to go ahead and devote some time to develop a plan that is going to work. We're concerned that, first of all, we want the neighborhood associations and the neighbors to be happy that we're building an eco-village in our community, rather, in their neighborhood. We want them to be involved in the planning. And we certainly don't want to force anything down anyone's throat when it comes to low-income housing. We want them to be excited. So we would like to form a planning committee that's going to be able to do all this and make everybody happy and get people into a nice, healthy lifestyle.
Michael, thanks very much for coming down to the KBOO studios today.
Absolutely.
We've been talking with Michael Withy, homeless advocate. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
Withy will be presenting his plan at the Human Rights Commission meeting on Wednesday, April 2nd at 4 p.m. The meeting will be located at 421 Southwest 6th Avenue, Suite 500, and is open to the public. 4 days have passed since a massive mudslide destroyed a small rural community near Seattle. As of today, there are 16 people confirmed dead, with an additional 8 likely dead. Authorities remain uncertain as to how many people are still missing, but estimates indicate that number could be as high as 176. County officials are in the process of compiling a list of the missing, developed from calls received from worried family and friends. Officials are hopeful that this means the number of missing might come down because more than one report could be about someone already on the working list. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with Shannon Wilson about the League of Wilderness Defenders after this newscast, talking about the bills introduced by Senator Ron Wyden to massively increase logging on public lands in Oregon. This will be followed by KBOO's youth collective show, The Underground, at 6 o'clock, the only show on the radio produced, recorded, and engineered entirely by people under the age of 21. Their theme for tonight's show will be The End. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather for the Portland area should be windy, with steady rain in the morning that will continue throughout the afternoon, and a high of 56 degrees. The chance of rain, 90%. It is 5:24. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If one obscure college professor dies, does it make any difference? If you're Margaret Mary Voitko, yes. In life, she was just another adjunct teacher at Duquesne University, being grossly underpaid and maltreated by the school. Her story would be unknown, except for Daniel Kovalik, a lawyer with the United Steelworkers. Daniel knew Margaret Mary through his union's drive to help adjunct teachers organize for better pay and treatment. He wrote up her story, telling how Duquesne had paid her so little that she spiraled into abject poverty. Then they coldly booted her. No severance, no goodbyes. Impoverished, abandoned, scared, and stressed to the limit, her heart exploded shortly afterwards. Yet, in death, Margaret Mary is more alive than ever. Kovalik's poignant piece swept through the internet, striking a chord with adjunct teachers everywhere. They see that their own low-wage position could put them in the same downward spiral it did for her. So Margaret Mary's story is being repeated all across the country, energizing organizing campaigns to empower and lift up these hard-hit university teachers. In a case of beautiful irony, one of their strongest campaigns is taking place at Duquesne. Adjuncts there have already voted to join the Steelworkers Union, but the domineering masters of this Catholic school are resorting to devious legalistic ploys to deny simple justice for their faculty. Bizarrely, they've even demanded a religious exemption from our labor laws, claiming that unionization would interfere with our teaching of Catholic values. This is Jim Hightower saying the Steelworkers Union president, Leo Gerard, has appealed that claim, not to the courts, but to the Pope. And to make his case that Pope Francis should speak out on this issue of social justice, Gerard told him the story of Margaret Mary Voitko. So in death, Margaret Mary even met the Pope.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Department of Justice accepted two petitions with over 100,000 signatures today supporting NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Snowden is currently in Russia under political asylum. One of the petitions calls for the restoration of Edward Snowden's passport, and the other calls for a U.S. government commitment to respect the political asylum status of Snowden in Russia. Acceptance of the petitions by the Justice Department followed an attempt earlier in the day to deliver the passport-related petition to the State Department, which declined to accept it. Both petitions, sponsored by the activist organization RootsAction.org and posted online, included thousands of individual comments. One of the speakers at the news conference was former whistleblower Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent and division counsel who was named one of Time magazine's Persons of the Year in 2002.
There's a huge difference between a so-called traitor and a whistleblower. The key is motivation. Robert Hansen and the FBI, the spy, Aldrich Ames and the CIA, were spies because they were absolutely selling the secrets in order to make themselves rich and to help an enemy country. Very different than when you're Frederick Whitehurst or Colleen Rowley or Daniel Ellsberg or Edward Snowden. Very different motivation. I'm really surprised people have not been able to grasp that. This Espionage Act is not applicable at all. Now, going through the proper channels should be an ideal. Unfortunately, since this has all started, some inspector generals who have tried, General Taguba, who tried to investigate the issue of torture, they are only at, Taguba was a three-star general. So if people were above him at a higher level where the orders were given, it's really impossible. Professor Vladek, I don't know if some of you know, he's a professor here at George Washington Law School, I believe, and he's an expert on this stuff, and he was in a debate recently, and he said, well, Snowden had no option, and he had no option because these orders and this post-9/11 lawless law of war type following instead of rule of law, this all began and from the highest levels. And when the orders have come down from the highest levels, it's not going to help you to skip a level and expose wrongdoing. And we need to fix this. We need to have independent, like the church committee. That's the only way that we can actually fix when high levels get involved in wrongdoing. We actually absolutely have to have an independent oversight.
Norman Solomon was another speaker at the press conference referring to the decision by the U.S. government to revoke Edward Snowden's passport.
We hear this calumny that somehow he ran to Russia, but it's a reflection, and actually in the pass out of the top sheet of these petitions that you have, I think one of the many thousands of eloquent signer comments alludes to this. This was the last place that, as things worked out, was safe for Edward Snowden to be, and that was Russia. And so the U.S. government was directly complicit and responsible by confiscating and revoking Edward Snowden's passport for having him be stuck in the airport in Moscow and be left with no other option. Now, it is true, to be fair, that Snowden did have another option. He could have come back to the United States and gotten the kind of treatment that Private Manning got, which was, according to one UN report, borderline, if not over the border, of torture. And how much did you hear from Private Manning, now Chelsea Manning, then Bradley Manning, during and after his arrest and throughout his captivity? This is an effort to silence through revocation of the passport, through forcing down an airliner of the head of a sovereign government in Latin America, as you may remember last summer. The Attorney General of the United States and the President of the United States are clearly today, just as they were 9 months ago, hell-bent on flipping over every rock and pulling out all stops to apprehend, if necessary by their lights, apparently even abduct Edward Snowden. And one of these petitions directly addresses that question. So the revocation of the passport and this continuing stance from the Obama White House, particularly ironic now during the news of the last day, that approach to Edward Snowden continues unabated and it continues to be reprehensible.
The petition submitted today to the U.S. Justice Department called for clemency for Edward Snowden, with supporters pointing out that President Obama himself has called for changes in the NSA's mass surveillance program following the exposure of the program by Edward Snowden. They argue that what they call the Orwellian vacuuming up of non-relevant information and metadata has already been determined as unreasonable and therefore unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment by at least one federal district judge, as well as by President Obama's own constitutional and privacy law review panels. Justice Department Public Affairs official Peter Carr accepted the boxes of petitions on the front steps of the Justice Department on Wednesday after the presenters were told by security officers to leave the building. The White House and the House Intelligence Committee have both issued proposals for ending the mass collection of American phone records. Both approaches focus on shifting custody of the phone records back to the phone companies. The committee proposal restricts the mass collection of data by the NSA, but gives increased power to retrieve called data while still in the hands of phone companies. The president's proposal would end the mass collection of phone records by the NSA, but would still allow other types of mass phone records by the mass collections of data, such as internet and finance records. Electronic rights advocates say the president's proposal looks promising, but they will need to see the details before they can support it. And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, March 26, 2014. Four Palestinian fishermen were wounded after Israeli Navy boats opened fire at their fishing boats near the Rafah shore in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Medical sources said that the four wounded Palestinians were moved to Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah, suffering moderate injuries. Moreover, Israeli Navy boats also fired a shell at nearby homes, and that several homes and boats were hit by the army fire, causing excessive property damage and four injuries. The Israeli Navy frequently attacks Palestinian fishermen and their boats in Palestinian territorial waters, even while their boats are docked at shore. Thousands of Palestinian families in Gaza depend on fishing as their only source of livelihood, risking their lives just to be able to fish and support their families. As part of the ceasefire agreement of November 2012, Israel agreed to allow the Palestinians to fish within 6 nautical miles, but unilaterally decreased the allotted area to 3 miles. In the West Bank, Israeli army bulldozers destroyed on Wednesday morning a large area of Palestinian farmlands in Umnir area near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Witnesses said that several bulldozers escorted by Israeli military vehicles leveled private Palestinian land in the village, taking out several fruit trees near Susia settlement. Israeli forces blocked off the area and declared it a closed military zone, preventing farmers from accessing their lands. The army attack coincided with the arrival of the British consulate delegation, which was visiting the Susia area to look into the living conditions of Palestinians residing there and the Israeli violations against them. In Jerusalem, Israeli bulldozers demolished a Palestinian residential building in Tur village on Wednesday under the pretext that it was built without the construction permit. Israeli forces closed off the area, while municipality staff dismantled gas, water and power lines and evacuated the inhabitants before demolishing the building. Earlier on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli troops kidnapped four Palestinians, including a Fatah official, from the districts of Jenin and Bethlehem, local sources reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, March 26, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
A judge in Egypt has ordered mass trials of more than 900 Islamist supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. This follows a mass trial on Monday in which the same judge sentenced more than 520 defendants to death. The defendants are being tried for murder and attempted murder. Judge Saeed Yusuf began a mass trial of nearly 700 men on Tuesday in spite of a boycott by defense lawyers. In total, more than 2,200 defendants are facing mass trials right now in Egypt for a wave of violence that broke out last August. The defendants, who are former members of Morsi's security forces and members of the Muslim Brotherhood, are accused of participating in a crackdown on protesters that resulted in 600 deaths. The U.S. government and the European Union criticized the mass trials, saying that it is inconceivable that so many defendants could receive a fair trial in a single session. The repercussions of two oil spills in the U.S. in the past week are still being assessed and investigated. In addition to a spill late last week in Texas, another spill has now been identified in Michigan. A BP oil refinery processing tar sands oil spilled oil into Lake Michigan on Monday. According to BP spokesman Dean Scott, the spill seems to be contained behind booms laid out, and initial reports show that winds have pushed the oil onto the shores near the refinery. It appears oil somehow entered the water cooling system and spilled into the lake, despite legal challenges by federal officials and environmental groups to take extra measures to curb environmental pollution. The Northeastern Indiana Refinery, the seventh largest in the nation, was expanded and opened by BP less than a year ago to process Canadian tar sands oil. The refinery is located 20 miles southeast of Chicago, and the spill occurred 8 miles from the source of drinking water for 8 million suburban residents of Chicago. In Texas's Galveston Bay, a larger spill caused by the closing of the nation's largest petrochemical complex and export terminal. The terminal was fully reopened today for the first time since a collision between two barges caused the spill on March 22nd. According to the U.S. Coast Guard, 168,000 gallons of oil spilled from the barge. The spill occurred near a wildlife sanctuary, causing concerns over birds protected in the sanctuary, as well as other marine life in the area. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott released a statement regarding the damage inflicted by the spill and its blow to small businesses, fishing, recreation, and the overall economy. The Environmental Protection Agency has proposed a new rule that will close loopholes in the Clean Water Act. Currently, over 61,000 miles of streams in Oregon are at risk of unchecked pollution. The new rule would change that and prevent the pollution of those smaller waterways. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Ricky Seguin of Environment Oregon.
Ricky, can you start by talking about the new rule released this week by the Environmental Protection Agency to close loopholes in the federal Clean Water Act?
Absolutely. So yesterday was a huge day for clean water when the EPA took the biggest step forward for clean water that we've seen in more than a decade. The Clean Water Act is meant to protect all of the waterways across the country, and unfortunately, there were a few polluter-led Supreme Court decisions back in 2001 and 2006. And what those decisions did was actually confuse which waterways were actually protected under the Clean Water Act and left about 61,000 miles of streams across Oregon unprotected. And so yesterday, the EPA took a huge step forward by proposing a rule to close up these loopholes in the Clean Water Act and make sure that all of our streams and wetlands receive the same protections that our massive rivers like the Columbia and the Rogue receive.
What is it going to mean for industry in the state?
What this means for businesses is that small waterways are no longer allowed to be used as personal sewers. So the normal federal protections that are afforded to large waterways will also be afforded to smaller waterways. We've worked closely with small businesses and small farmers across the state who rely on clean water for their business and are equally excited to see these new protections being proposed.
Is this a federal protection that would apply to all states so that businesses which are polluters would not be able to just, say, move their business elsewhere to another state where they can dump in the water?
Exactly, yeah. This is a rule that would affect the entire country. So it's going to help protect the drinking water for about 117 million Americans. So it's definitely a huge step forward and a really exciting piece of news.
And what is the status of this rule? You say it's proposed right now?
Yeah, what happens from here is the EPA has proposed this rule, and soon, we don't know the exact date of when, but very soon there'll be a public comment period that opens up for everyday people to comment on this, hopefully saying that they're on board and agree that clean water is a great thing in this country. And then after the end of the comment period, it'll be up to President Obama to finalize the rule.
And given the current climate in Congress right now, is there a chance that the U.S. Congress would be able to prevent this from happening in some way?
There's always that sort of fear in the background. You know, we've seen plenty of attacks on clean water and EPA jurisdiction in Congress over the past few years. So we're working with both our elected officials here in Oregon and then also across the country to make sure that we have a safeguard in Congress because, yes, after the administration, fingers crossed, goes through with this rule, Congress would have the opportunity to vote to stop it. But I feel confident that as popular as this issue is, our elected officials will be able to stand up for it and get it in the book.
But it doesn't actually have to be approved by the Congress.
Correct. It doesn't have to be approved by the Congress. Just what Congress could do if they so chose is use a Congressional Review Act to overturn it potentially.
Again, I've been speaking with Ricky Seguin with Environment Oregon, their website environmentoregon.org. We've been talking about the Environmental Protection Agency proposing a rule this week to close loopholes in the Clean Water Act that leave 53% of Oregon's streams and wetlands at risk of unchecked pollution and development. This rule, if it does get passed, will protect the drinking water for 1.7 million Oregonians that are currently at risk. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Jones, Robin Ryan, Sadia Khan, and Rachel Bennett. Special thanks to reporter Jamie Partridge. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. This number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with investigative journalist Greg Pallast about this week's 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez disaster. At 9 o'clock, hear Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with host Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on A Deeper Look, the guest is Julia Angwin, author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off. Instead, we'll go straight to Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host David Nyman interviews author Helen Oyeyemi about her new novel, Boy, Snow, Bird. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, S.W. Konzer interviews Vivienne Haar, the 10-year-old anti-slavery activist at the heart of the documentary, Stand With Me. He'll also be joined by local Student Academy Awards coordinator Thomas Phillipson and filmmaker Andy Chandler to talk about the upcoming Filmed by Bike Festival. Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting KBOO Community Radio. If you are not a member, please go to kboo.fm and click on the Donate Today button to become one. Stay tuned now for an interview conducted by KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about the proposed legislation to allow massive increases in logging on public lands in Oregon, and have a great evening.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani! Boing, boing. Hello, Mr. and Ms.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking now with Shannon Wilson, who is with the League of Wilderness Defenders. And I wonder if you could start by talking about the Farm Bill Salvage Rider and what the impact will be in Oregon.
Hi there. Yes. Anyway, the Farm Bill, which was signed into law back in February by President Obama, had a provision in it that was added to the Farm Bill by the House of Representatives pretty much on the last day it was in the House. And that provision basically provides funding about $200 million a year for the next 10 years to basically create and produce timber sales and biomass extraction projects across the entire western United States.
How is it that this was added into the Farm Bill?
Well, like I say, it was added at the very last day or so when it was in the House of Representatives. So probably a lot of politicians, congressmen, probably didn't even know it was added until after it already passed. But then it went to the Senate. And then Senator Wyden and most of all the other Democrats voted for this. And at the same time, they're taking $200 million a year to fund these timber sales for national forests across the West. They're cutting $800 million a year from the food stamp program. So basically, they're taking food out of hungry people's mouths to basically give it to the timber industry for timber sales to keep these huge mills running, and, you know, while they export raw logs and raw chips overseas by literally boatloads. And it's, you know, it's kind of Orwellian what's going on with the Democratic Party. They're supposed to be the party that is protecting the environment, but everyone seems to be giving them a pass as far as, calling them out on these things if they say they believe in global warming, while they do nothing about global warming or greenhouse gases releases. They're enacting laws to destroy the last ancient forest in the western United States.
And Senator Wyden was a supporter of this salvage rider?
He voted for it it was in the Senate. And in fact, the specific law that this refers to, this $200 million refers to, is called the Healthy Forest Restoration Act. Now, in 2002 and 2003, Senator Wyden was one of the lead co-sponsors of the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, and then it was signed into law by George Bush back in 2003 and enacted. So Senator Wyden has not been a friend of the forest or ancient forest for at least a decade now. And this bill and other bills that he's proposing just prove that case, that he's not there to protect the environment.
Well, let's talk about the other bills that Senator Wyden currently has proposed that have not yet passed. The SB 1784, which is the Oregon and California Land Grant Act of 2014, which would double logging in 1 million acres of Western Oregon Bureau of Land Management land. Let's talk about that. What's the impact if that law does actually pass?
Well, you know, we've been opposing this bill for at least a year now. What they want to do is double amount of logging, up to, say, 300 to 350 million board feet per year. And in fact, I just heard not too long ago that Senator Wyden and Mr. Fazio are going to get together and maybe even try to increase that number to more than 300 to 350 million board feet a year. On top of that, it would seek to eliminate survey and manage provisions, which are basically some of the strongest provisions of the Northwest Forest Plan that protect rare, uncommon, or endemic species. One of those species is like the red tree vole that actually gets protection. Those protections would be removed, as well as protections for endangered species.
Why the push to increase logging at this time in Oregon, especially given that these are the last of Oregon's old growth, with the rest having already been logged?
Well, you know, I think it, for the most part, they're just desperate. The timber industry has pretty much cut everything on their lands, you know, their private industrial lands, and pretty much put them on boats, raw logs on boats, and chips, wood chips, and they're shipping them out. So they're running out of trees to cut on their own lands, and now they're looking at, it's like, oh, wow, well, look at all this forest over here between 100 and 200 years old that if we can get our hands on, we could keep our mega mills operating for another 5 or 10 years. And that's what they're looking at. You know, they're coming up to a wall of not having any more trees on their lands, and they're looking at public lands to support their mills and their profit margin.
Well, regardless of whether they're able to log this land now or at some point in the future, they are going to run out. Wyden is pushing for jobs right now in Oregon. Those jobs doesn't seem like are going to be sustainable. Are there alternatives that you see to providing more sustainable and long-term jobs in the state of Oregon?
Sure there is. I mean, there's plenty of restoration jobs out there. It's just a matter of where's the funding going to come from. I mean, the timber industry doesn't want to pay for any of the restoration and the damage they've done, obviously. And they've avoided paying taxes to the state of Oregon to the tune of billions of dollars over the last 20 or 30 years that could have supported these counties and schools that are struggling. But they've, you know, pretty much have the Democratic Party in their pocket when it comes to getting tax breaks and loopholes over these last 20 or 30 years. So, yeah, funding's got to come from somewhere. And, you know, we've got over 100,000 miles of logging roads in our national forests and BLM lands just in the Pacific Northwest. And at some point, those logging roads either have to be removed or, you know, they're just going to fail on their own with, you know, climate change and things like that happening and increases of downpours and rainfall, let's say, in the spring and such. We're going to have more mudslides like what's going on around the Northwest, not less, if we don't deal with these roads. And that could be providing tens of thousands of jobs, not to mention salmon recovery and restoration projects to help bring back the salmon or keep the salmon, what's still left in our streams, there for the future. So there's, you know, that's probably enough work for the next 100 years. We've taken 100 years to do all the damage. Probably going to take 100 years or more to fix it if we'd actually get around to doing it. So, yeah, and, you know, their money's there. They're throwing through $200 million a year to fund timber sales and biomass extraction projects. Why couldn't they throw $200 million a year to actually do something good for ecosystems in our communities?
And these bills that are being proposed by Senator Wyden, you mentioned the word Orwellian. The names themselves seem to imply that they are protecting the forest, when in fact, as you point out, they're doing the opposite. We've got SB 1784, the Oregon and California Land Grant Act. Then we've also got SB 1301, the Oregon East Side Forest Restoration, Old Growth Protection, and Jobs Act. What does that bill do if it does indeed pass the Senate?
Well, that bill is just for east of the Cascades, all the national forests in Oregon. Basically, it's just another logging bill. It's another Timber Baron Welfare Act, is what I like to call it, regardless of what Senator Wyden and the Democratic Party call it. It's basically there to produce timber and biomass for the timber industry. And based on what I've information I've talked to Karen Coulter with the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, she basically says that it's going to double the amount of logging in national forests in eastern Oregon, and it's pretty much going to erase all the good work that she has done over in eastern Oregon for the last 20 years protecting forests. Size limits will be thrown out. Right now there's a 21 inch in diameter size limit, because trees generally bigger than 21 inches in diameter are probably old growth, ponderosa, or other species. And, you know, they're doing this in the name of forest health, reducing fire fuels, etc. But, yes, quoted from the bill, it's right here. It's in the first year, not less than 60,000 acres of eastern Oregon's national forest will be treated. And treated here, defined by them, is predominantly comprised of mechanical treatment that emphasize saw timber as a byproduct. And then in the second year, it would mandate 80,000 acres be chainsawed to health. Third year, it would be over 100,000 acres. And this bill wouldn't expire until 2029. Another really bad part of the bill, it would allow trees up to 200 years old to be cut to pay for this so-called restoration logging and fire fuel thinning. So where's the old growth protection in the language that Senator Wyden, you know, touts as his Old Growth Forest Protection Act?
Wow, so it sounds pretty dire. We're hearing about planned clear cuts both in western Oregon and east of the Cascades as well. How are people organizing to oppose these bills and this logging? Are there ways that people can find out more or get involved?
For the most part, there's just a few groups who are really on the front lines trying to stop this stuff. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is focused on eastern Oregon. Karen Coulter, our group, Legal Wilderness Defenders, we're trying to defend western Oregon as well. There's the Cascadia Forest Defenders, who have actually put up tree sits to occupy one of the sales that is touted as one of Senator Wyden's ecological forestry models for his East West Side bill. And, you know, we're still waiting for other bigger groups to step up. We're wondering where the Sierra Club is and other big organizations as far as where's their campaigns to oppose these things. We haven't seen a lot. We had a billboard up in November and December here on I-5, and we're doing everything we can, but we operate on a shoestring budget. None of us get paid, and so, you know, we've had groups also, like the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. Their organization seems to be oblivious of all this stuff and is continuing to endorse Democrats who are promoting all this logging and destruction. So, you know, we're kind of at a loss why they would do that.
So the groups, if people want to find out more information, the Cascadia Forest Defenders, their website is forestdefensenow.com. That's all one word, forestdefensenow.com. And you can find out about the tree sits there and other actions that people are engaging in to protect Oregon old growth forest. There's also the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. And if you are interested in talking to your legislators, the bills we've been talking about are SB 1784 and SB 1301. Those are both introduced by Senator Ron Wyden. SB 1784 and SB 1301, which are bills to increase logging throughout the state of Oregon. You've got a petition on your website to oppose these bills as well. What is the website?
Our website is eco-advocates.org, and that's for our group Eco Advocates Northwest, which is a project under the League of Wilderness Defenders.
So if you are interested, you can find the petition opposing the logging bills that Senator Wyden has proposed on that website, eco-advocates.org. Again, eco-advocates.org. I want to thank you so much for speaking with us. I've been speaking with Shannon Wilson with the League of Wilderness Defenders out there on the front lines trying to protect Oregon's last old-growth forests and ecosystems. Thanks for joining us today, Shannon.
Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Hi, this is Justin Miller, KBOO's underwriting coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KABU. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kabu.fm/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kabu.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KABU Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
Stupid car.
Yeah, it was kind of a POS, wasn't it?
It was such a junker. We were going to donate it to the radio station.
Oh, do they accept vehicle donations?
Yes, that was the plan, you goofball. We were going to donate it to KABU, but no. Instead, what happens? We leave it in the stupid yard, and then Bigfoot comes.
Yeah, he took it off our hands.
Yeah, he took it. He took our car. It's not like we can deduct Grand Theft Sasquatch from our taxes. We could have taken it off on our taxes if we brought it to KABU.
Don't let this happen to you. Donate your vehicle to KABU Community Radio before Bigfoot steals it. For more information, call 877-526-6123 or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Hello, you're listening to The Underground on KABU.fm. It is 6:02, and the station ID is 90.7 FM. Today's Youth Collective show theme is The End, which is... you know, it could be heavy. It could be the end of something bad. In which case, it could be good. You know, there's like lots of ways to interpret it. And my, you know, wish for you guys is to think about the end, however you may interpret it. All right.
I was never cool in school. I'm sure you don't remember me. And now it's been 10 years, I'm still wondering who to be. And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries. That's me. Hand me my nose and we'd be happy. Show me the mosh pit and we'd be happy. We can be
alrighty, our first piece themed about the end is by Ellie.
Hello, this is Ellie with the KABU Youth Collective. Today I am calling my father to talk about the end of the world. Okay, hello Dad, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, so I am calling you today to ask you a few questions about the end of the world and what you would do. What would you bring if it was the end of the world?
When you say the end of the world, do you mean like I'm going to die like in 10 minutes? Or is it I have to go hide in the woods? Or what are you saying?
What do you think about a zombie apocalypse and what would you bring?
I think the main thing that I would think about, I would want to make sure my daughter, you, were safe and that you're with me. And then I would try to protect you from whatever was happening and make sure that you had food and shelter and that you were warm and safe. I'd make sure I would have some way to start a fire, maybe some weapons to protect ourselves. And once all the basic stuff was done, then I would want to make sure, music, I guess. That's the first thing that pops to my mind. I want to make sure at the end of the world, if I'm off in some island, that I have my desert island disc.
Honey, I love you, yeah, I do.
bring the essentials like food, water, my cat, all the essentials, because you're not going to have time to listen to music. Your life is on the line. I know you've seen a lot of zombie movies like Shaun of the Dead. I mean, I've seen that movie.
You've seen Shaun of the Dead?
Dad, I'm on the radio. So I would bring more essentials, not like music. I mean, you could bring an iPod or something, but I have another question. What do you think about the real end of the world? It's going to be the end of the world in a week. What would you do?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, again, my first thought is to you. I want to make sure that I got to spend time with you.
What do you
do? That I was at peace with myself, maybe do something that I've never done that I wanted to do. Depending on if everyone knew the world was going to end and everyone was panicking, or if no one knew, go somewhere nice and warm and sunny with nice beaches and just be able to relax.
Would you do anything crazy? What would be your bucket list? Like something adventurous?
I'd always want to see the pyramids, but I don't think I'd want to do that at the end of the world. I'd want to go somewhere that was just beautiful, lush, white sand beaches, blue water, and just really peaceful and relaxing. Play in the sun, soak up the rays, and go swimming, go surfing, snorkeling, and just enjoy the last week of life on Earth and reflect on what my life has been and what will happen after I'm gone. I'd want to make sure that I called my parents and my sisters and my other relatives and my friends that I really love and care about and tell them how I feel about them. And I think that, you know, when you think about your life ending all of a sudden, you think about doing things like that. But that's something you should do right now. You know, you can, if you get in a fight with someone and you realize how silly sometimes those fights can be, that's time to, you know, make peace with those people. And right now, when it's not happening, to call the people you love and remind them, like, I'm going to call my mom tonight and tell her I love her. And, you know, call my friends that I really miss and tell them that I love them and make plans to see them soon.
I think that that's very nice. And I liked how you said that we should do that right now. Like, call my grandma, talk to everyone, and tell them that how we really feel. Because, I mean, they could die any day. I really like how you say that.
You have to live in the present and take advantage of what you have now and be grateful for what you have. Show appreciation and love.
Yes.
That you do appreciate and love.
If it was...